Chapter 21 The Return. For a second day in the autumn of 2011, the delegates of the only political party that really mattered in Russia gathered in Luzhniki Stadium, the country's premier sporting arena, constructed in the 1950s at the height of Soviet might. It anchored the only Olympic Games ever held in the Soviet Union, in Moscow in 1980. And would soon be refurbished to serve as the main venue for the World Cup in 2018. In December 2010, Russia had won the competition to host the tournament despite a lackluster bid that appeared doomed until Putin personally intervened to oversee the proposal and tap the country's oligarchs for contributions. Russia was accused of trading votes with Qatar, which also bid and won the cup for 2022. Votes that would remain a source of controversy and scandal for the sport's governing body, FIFA. There were even accusations that Russia had offered paintings from the storerooms of the State Hermitage Museum in Petersburg as gifts to delegates who would ultimately vote to award the cup. One painting was said to be a Picasso. The other was a landscape described by the recipient as absolutely ugly. On that day in September, more than 10,000 delegates of United Russia filled grandstands adorned with party banners and red, white, and blue flags. The gathering resembled not an American-style party convention, but rather a display of fealty to party and state that more than a few observers noticed had an echo of the old Communist Party congresses with row after row of balding or gray-haired men and uniformed generals, festooned with medals from the glorious Soviet past. Only now, the production was far slicker. A made-for-television affair that synthesized Soviet-like propaganda with state-of-the-art techniques and technology from the West. It was just 2.5 months before the newest round of parliamentary elections, which the party would, of course, win. Behind the orchestrated display, however, not all was well. The party's reputation had taken a dive after the Duma's failure to do much of anything beneficial for ordinary Russians during its last session, a turbulent period of economic and political crises. The party had by now become an object of ridicule, the brunt of jokes and scandal. The Duma had become a chamber filled with apparatchiks and opportunists, with Putin loyalists and celebrities like Alina Kabayeva, or Andrei Luguvoy, who were recruited and elected on party lists, rather than politicians with genuine constituencies to answer to. In February 2011, Alexei Navalny, a lawyer who had built a public following by exposing rampant corruption on a blog he kept, had called for a grassroots campaign to destroy United Russia for the sake of the country's democratic future. In a radio interview, he said that the party had become a manifestation of all that was wrong in Russia, and added, almost as an aside, an appellation that proved to be catchy and, not surprisingly, durable. He called United Russia the party of swindlers and thieves. Navalny had been active in democratic politics since the late 1990s, when he joined the Yabloko party. But he grew increasingly frustrated by that party's declining relevance and infighting. He was expelled after participating in the Russian March, an annual demonstration of nationalists that was anathema to Yabloko's liberals. He opened a law firm for a time, but only gained prominence when, like William Browder, he began to investigate the dealings of the opaque state corporations that dominated Russia's economy. His tactic was simple: acquire shares and investigate their books. As the owner of just 2 shares of Transneft, the oil transport monopoly, he demanded to know why the company had donated $300 million to charity in 2007 and yet paid such paltry dividends to its shareholders. He had, it seemed, uncovered the company's scheme to direct huge sums of money to the Kremlin, specifically the Federal Protective Service, which provided security to state officials and was headed by Putin's longtime bodyguard, Viktor Zolotov. Navalny had no legal investigative power, but he used the last free space for public discourse in Russia, the Internet, to compile a virtual catalog of malfeasance, conflicts of interest, and rapacious profiteering from the state's budget coffers. Expanding beyond Transneft, He highlighted the suspect and usually wildly inflated contracts of government agencies and corporations, the shady business activities of the Duma's deputies, and the luxurious properties they and government officials were able to acquire for themselves and their children despite their modest official salaries. He did what Sergei Magnitsky had done, piecing together a trail of evidence from public records that had become more open, if not exactly transparent, in part because of initiatives proposed by Medvedev, including one requiring that all government tenders be posted online. He created a website, rospil.ru, that became a forum for scrutinizing these tenders and managed to create enough public scandal to force the cancellation of some contracts, though few meaningful government prosecutions ever resulted from his disclosures. Navalny tapped into a simmering discontent with the Duma, with the system, even with Putin himself. It made him famous, and he made no secret of his ambition to lead a political movement that would steer Russia another way. Tall, blonde, and handsome, with a chiseled jaw and a sense of joyous outrage, he seemed the first political figure to emerge from the atomized opposition who had the attributes to become a viable challenger to Putin himself. That could not go unnoticed for long. Nor could the role Medvedev's liberalizing reforms had played in enabling Navalny's dangerous and unexpected challenge to power. Until the second Khodorkovsky trial, Medvedev had never openly contradicted Putin, never challenged him in any way. But as the end of his term as president approached, an undeclared campaign between the camps loyal to each man began to surface. In January 2011, one of Medvedev's advisors, Arkady Dvorkovich, publicly warned that the second Khodorkovsky trial had harmed the investment climate in Russia, reinforcing the perception that justice in Russia was capricious and deeply corrupted. Weeks later, Medvedev returned to Davos, where he had made his international debut 4 years before, and outlined ambitious plans to modernize Russia's economy, reassuring investors that, Khodorkovsky's case notwithstanding, the country welcomed foreign investors and capital. Only days before his trip to Davos, Medvedev had pushed the New START agreement negotiated with Barack Obama through the Duma, and while in Switzerland, he pledged to revive the talks to enter the World Trade Organization that Putin had upended in 2009. With the election of a new parliament scheduled for the end of the year, and the presidential election 3 months after that, Medvedev presented a competing path for the future, and the insiders in the Kremlin and the government gravitated either toward his or toward Putin's. The first question Medvedev faced at Davos was one he had not addressed in his remarks, and one that would prove decisive. It was about the Arab Spring, which had begun in Tunis in December 2010 and inspired protests that swept through the Arab world, toppling Hosni Mubarak in Egypt and threatening Colonel Muammar al-Qaddafi in Libya. Medvedev replied not only that he recognized the democratic aspirations of the thousands who had poured into Tunisia's streets to protest corruption, poverty, and lack of political rights, but also that governments had a responsibility to address those grievances. He went on to emphasize the importance of the relationship between governed and government in ways that could have applied equally to Russia, where the will of the people had been managed out of the electoral process. When governments fail to keep up with social change and fail to meet people's hopes, disorganization and chaos ensue, sadly, Medvedev said, apparently warming to the theme. This is a problem of governments themselves and the responsibility they bear. Even if governments in power find many of the demands made unacceptable, they still must remain in dialogue with all the different groups, because otherwise they lose their real foundation. The protests in the Arab world had galvanized Russia's beleaguered opposition, at least in the still safe space of the internet, and Medvedev's remarks sounded sympathetic to things that Putin feared most. Medvedev, while hardly endorsing protests at home, sounded irresolute. The American Vice President, Joseph Biden, even had the audacity to quote him during a speech at Moscow State University in March 2011, in which he declared that Russians should have the same rights as anyone else. Most Russians want to choose their national and local leaders in competitive elections, Biden said in what amounted to an endorsement in the undeclared campaign taking shape. They want to be able to assemble freely, and they want a media to be independent of the state. And they want to live in a country that fights corruption. That's democracy. They're the ingredients of democracy. So I urge all of you students here, don't compromise on the basic elements of democracy. You need not make that Faustian bargain. Behind the scenes, Biden used his visit to press Medvedev to support a United Nations Security Council resolution to authorize a military intervention in Libya, where peaceful protests had turned into an armed insurrection against the country's dictator, Muammar al-Qaddafi. The United States, its NATO allies, and some Arab nations wanted to establish a no-fly zone over the country to prevent the bloody suppression of the rebels. Medvedev agreed, persuaded by the humanitarian case for intervention, despite the opposition of the foreign ministry and other security officials who saw the prospect of a NATO-led campaign outside its border as an extension of American hegemony to another part of the world. He had drifted dangerously far from Putin's path, making a confrontation seem inevitable. Only weeks before, Putin had warned that the uprisings in Libya and other countries would fuel the rise of Islamic extremists allied with al-Qaeda, aided and abetted by short-sighted sympathizers in the West trying to overthrow autocratic leaders. He was not wrong about the rise in extremism, which would later consume Libya and exacerbate a grinding civil war in Syria, a far more important ally of Russia in the Middle East. Putin's support for the autocratic dictators of Libya and Syria was widely viewed through the prism of Russia's geopolitical interests, including energy projects and a contract to build a railway linking Libya's coastal cities, negotiated by Putin's friend Vladimir Yakunin, massive arms sales, and, in the case of Syria, Russia's only military base outside the former Soviet Union. In truth, his wariness ran much deeper. There existed a dark association in his mind between aspirations for democracy and the rise of radicalism, between elections and the chaos that would inevitably result. "Let's take a look back at history, if you don't mind," Putin said in Brussels in February. "Where did Khomeini, the mastermind of the Iranian Revolution, live?" "He lived in Paris, and he was supported by most of Western society. And now the West is facing the Iranian nuclear program. I remember our partners calling for fair, democratic elections in the Palestinian territories. Excellent! Those elections were won by Hamas." Reflexively, instinctively, he imagined the uprising in Libya as simply another step toward a revolution being orchestrated for Moscow. Perhaps it was because he was younger, perhaps because he never served in the security services, perhaps because of his convivial nature, but Medvedev did not share this bleak distrust of the West, of democracy, of human nature. He had spent the first 3 years of his presidency wooed by Barack Obama's administration, and now not only the United States, but countries with much closer relations to Russia, including France and Italy, were appealing to him to help prevent a slaughter of civilians in Libya. And so, on his instruction, Russia abstained when the Security Council voted on United Nations Resolution 1973 on March 17th, authorizing the use of military force to stop Gaddafi's forces from moving on the insurgent stronghold in eastern Libya. Medvedev's decision provoked a revolt among Russia's diplomats and security officials. Russia's ambassador to Libya, Vladimir Khamov, sent a cable to the president warning against the loss of an important ally. Medvedev fired him, but the ambassador returned to Moscow and declared publicly that the president was acting against Russia's interests. When NATO launched its first airstrikes 2 days later, a far more punishing initial barrage to destroy the country's air defenses than many expected, Medvedev seemed to many in Russia to be complicit in yet another American-led war. One of the Prime Minister's closest advisers later claimed that Putin had not read the Security Council's resolution before the vote, deferring to the President and being preoccupied, as he was, with economic diplomacy rather than foreign affairs. Once the bombing started, however, Putin understood its import. The unstated goal of the NATO air war was not merely the protection of civilians caught in the crossfire, but rather the overthrow of Gaddafi's regime. He believed that Medvedev had been duped. Putin read through the text of the resolution and saw that some countries could use the rubbery language to act the way they did, the advisor said. As NATO bombs rained on Libya, Putin spoke out. Touring a weapons factory, he denounced the United Nations resolution as flawed and inadequate. If one reads it, then it immediately becomes clear that it authorizes anyone to take any measures against a sovereign state. All in all, it reminds me of a medieval call to crusade, when someone calls upon others to go somewhere and free someone else. He compared it to the American wars of the previous decade, the bombings of Serbia, Afghanistan, and, under a fabricated pretext, Iraq. Now it's Libya's turn. Putin's spokesman said he had merely expressed a personal opinion, but with Medvedev already facing criticism for the resolution, it was an unmistakable rebuke. Medvedev promptly assembled the Kremlin's press pool at his dacha outside Moscow to defend Russia's abstention and, at least obliquely, to criticize Putin. He wore a leather bomber jacket with a fur collar zipped up tight. Appearing stern and a little uncomfortable, even nervous, he said the Security Council's action had been justified in light of Libya's actions. He sounded defensive. Russia's decision not to veto the resolution had been a qualified decision to help find a resolution to the exploding conflict. Everything that is happening in Libya is a result of the Libyan leadership's absolutely intolerable behavior and the crimes that they have committed against their own people. Even as he expressed concern about the extent of the Allied bombing campaign, which would continue for 8 more months, he warned that Putin's language would not help end the fighting. "I think we need to be very careful in our choice of words. It is inadmissible to say anything that could lead to a clash of civilizations, talk of crusades and so on. This is unacceptable." As his term wound down, Medvedev redoubled his efforts to make liberalizing reforms in the economy, as if his time were running out. In one instance, he decreed that government ministers could no longer serve on the boards of the state corporations that Putin had made a centerpiece of his economic policy. Medvedev himself had served on Gazprom's board while chief of staff and later deputy prime minister, but the move to bar officials from wearing two hats was an effort to weaken his chief rival in Putin's camp, Igor Sechin, who had served as deputy prime minister and chairman of Rosneft. Putin ultimately agreed to the measure, but exempted Gazprom, where Putin's close ally and former prime minister Viktor Zubkov remained in place. Medvedev's desire to remain as president for another term was palpable, though he could not risk openly declaring it. He and Putin may have been fighting a primary of sorts, but the only vote that mattered was Putin's, and Medvedev knew it. In May, after 3 years in office, Medvedev held his first press conference, the event that Putin had used each year to great effect to demonstrate his mastery of politics and government. Medvedev's was a pale imitation of Putin's performances, though, and coming so late in his term, it seemed an act of political desperation. He held it at Skolkovo, the still-evolving technological center he hoped would one day become a new Silicon Valley. Although he professed allegiance to Putin and praised their mutual commitment to the country's interests, he said he did not think that relations with NATO were that bad, despite the war in Libya, and declared that Ukraine had every right to pursue its integration with Europe, something that Putin had viewed as a cataclysmic threat. In response to a question about replacing regional governors, he seemed to allude to the perpetuity of Putin's power, saying that leaders should not cling to office for too long, but rather make way for a new generation, as was happening in Tunisia and Egypt. I think this is important because no one can stay in power forever, he said. People who harbor such illusions usually come to a rather bad end, and the world has given us quite a few examples of late. As the war in Libya dragged on, however, Medvedev's handling of the presidency became an open target for criticism in the media, signaled no doubt by Putin's own moves. In May, he announced the creation of a new organization, the All-Russia People's Front, which was intended to expand the political coalition at the heart of his power and to distance him from the party of swindlers and thieves. Within days, hundreds of organizations, unions, associations, and factories were rushing to join. The sole point of the project was to make Putin, not the country's sitting president, the national leader who would unite them. Medvedev pressed ahead with his proposals to reform the economy, freeing up capital and innovation, but he was losing ground. He met privately with 27 of the country's leading businessmen, the oligarchs who, like everyone else, awaited the resolution of the presidential primary with growing alarm. He implored them to support his proposals, and by implication, his candidacy, or to accept the stagnant status quo. Some of those in attendance interpreted Medvedev's remarks as an ultimatum for them to choose, but his message was so muddled that the participants could not be sure of his desire or his ability to fight to hold office. Afterward, they mocked his appeals, according to one of those who attended. Have you already decided? In June, in an interview with the Financial Times, Medvedev acknowledged for the first time that he wanted to return for a second term, but then he had to admit that it was not his decision alone. I think that any leader who occupies such a post as president simply must want to run, he said. But another question is whether he is going to decide whether he's going to run for the presidency or not. So his decision is somewhat different from his willingness to run. So this is my answer. If Medvedev wanted to assert real political independence, he did not show it. He could have used any of his appearances or interviews to openly declare his intention to run, perhaps even against Putin himself, presenting a real choice to voters. Instead, he was left awkwardly not answering the question that by the summer of 2011 seemed to have dragged the country into a prolonged political crisis, recalling the uncertainties of the 2008 problem. Unnatural disasters unfolded like sad symptoms of the country's paralysis, including the sinking of a ferry boat on the Volga River in July that drowned more than 120 people, and the crash of an airplane carrying the players and coaches of one of the country's professional hockey teams, Lokomotiv Yaroslavl. Medvedev was scheduled days later to hold a conference in the team's hometown, Yaroslavl, and it seemed a terrible omen. By then, even senior ministers were afraid to attend these conferences, lest it be seen as an endorsement of Medvedev over Putin. Putin's steely charisma, his absolute determination, his ability to remain above the trials of Russian life, shielded him from blame when tragedies like these struck. Medvedev, though, looked overwhelmed as president. Perhaps by design, public blame for the sinking and the crash flowed toward him. Putin's prominence in state media suddenly surged noticeably, an orchestrated campaign that seemed to highlight the personal, even physical, differences between the two men. Putin appeared at the summer camp of the youth group Nashi. He prayed at one of the holiest sites of Russian Orthodoxy. He dove in the Black Sea to the ruins of an ancient Greek city and, behold, surfaced clutching two amphorae. That his spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, later acknowledged that the discovery was staged was an unnoticed footnote to the televised image of a man in a tight wetsuit, still fit and very much in his prime. By the time United Russia's delegates gathered at Luzhniki in September, there remained a shivering uncertainty, even bewilderment, as another political transition approached. Even as they drafted their party platform for the elections, then only 10 weeks away, no one, not even the party leaders or the closest aides of Putin or Medvedev, knew whether a choice had been made or whether the excruciating limbo ahead of the 2012 presidential campaign would continue. Inside the stadium on that Saturday morning, the delegates listened to speeches extolling the stunning transformation of an ideological empire that had rotted and collapsed and now risen again, presided over, it was made clear, by one man, Putin. Boris Gritslov, the Duma speaker, looked like an apparatchik of old, his face stern and pinched as he read the party's platform, droning on about pledges of prosperity and competence. Eventually, the lights dimmed and the crowd hushed. From the wings, lit like rock stars, Putin and Medvedev entered the Congress, striding side by side, their shoulders swaying in tandem. Putin had a look of utter assuredness, which is what his supporters have said the country always craved. Not the shamed visage of a cowering leader of a diminished power. Putin spoke first, adhering to the protocol of political rank. He began by referring to the most pressing challenges facing our nation, and then addressed the most acute question on the delegates' minds with an elaborate tease. He stopped short of revealing what exactly the answer was, just as he had done in the private councils he had held with his various aides in the preceding days. "I am aware that United Russia members, supporters, and the delegates of this conference are expecting the Russian president and prime minister to voice proposals on the country's power configuration and government structure after the elections," he said. "I want to tell you directly that we have long since reached an agreement on what we will be doing in the future. That agreement was reached several years ago. However, following this debate as observers, both Mr. Medvedev and I said that it is hardly the most important thing, who will do which job and occupy which position. What's more important is the quality of work, what results we achieve, and how our people perceive our efforts, what their reaction is to our proposals for the nation's future development, and whether they support us." Putin's words spoke volumes about his understanding of democracy. "It is not for society to decide its leaders through some semblance of an electoral campaign, but to ratify those already chosen." He announced that Medvedev would, according to a tradition not even a decade old, head the party's ballot in the parliamentary elections in December, and thus guarantee its anticipated and honest victory. The applause that followed seemed rote. Putin had not yet clarified the fate of either man in the tandem. Medvedev then followed him to the dais. "Naturally, it is a pleasure to speak here," he began, smiling awkwardly. Even after 4 years in office, he had not yet mastered the art of political speech. "There is a special energy in this room. It is simply charged with emotions." He praised Russia's democracy and the new level of political culture that it had achieved. But he went on to warn that excessive formalism and bureaucracy posed a danger to it. The delegates listened unemotionally. His relevance seemed to dim with each word. "They lead to the stagnation and degradation of the political system," he said. "And unfortunately, we have already witnessed this in our country's history." He outlined an 8-point political agenda, all of which he had promised for nearly 4 years and not yet delivered. Modernizing the economy and industry, ensuring salaries, pensions, and health care, all precarious still, fighting corruption, strengthening the judiciary and criminal justice systems, combating illegal immigration while protecting the country's interethnic and interreligious peace, establishing a modern political system, building the nation's police and armed forces, and forging a strong, independent, sensible foreign policy. With those words, he accepted Putin's nomination to head the party's list, and at last he addressed the agreement Putin had alluded to having reached years before. Medvedev spoke like a man reading his own political obituary. It was, in fact, one of the most bizarre resignation speeches in history. He was articulating and defending his vision for the country, even as he relinquished the post that might have made it achievable. I propose we decide on another very important issue, which naturally concerns the party and all of our people who follow politics, namely the candidate for the role of president. In light of the proposal that I head the party list, do party work, and if we perform well in the elections, my willingness to engage in practical work in the government, I think it's right that the party Congress support the candidacy of the current Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin, in the role of the country's president. In the end, perhaps, it was not a surprise. Medvedev's political stock had been sinking day by day for most of the year. Yet the shock was audible in the cavernous stadium, a collective gasp that soon turned to thunderous applause, wave after wave of it. Putin had succeeded in creating suspense and then releasing it at the moment of his choosing. He stood in front of his seat in the audience, basking in the spotlight, his eyes sparkling, though his smile was tight, wry, and fleeting. He did not raise his arms in triumph or otherwise act like a candidate offered the chance to seek higher office. He simply nodded knowingly, as if his return to the presidency was preordained. After Medvedev finished speaking, Putin strode to the dais a second time and delivered a lengthy, richly detailed, policy-laden address that outlined his plans to support veterans and farmers, doctors, teachers, scientists, soldiers. It was the nuts and bolts of governance, what the Russians had come to expect over years of watching him insist upon the right policy, the right decisions, on behalf of the people. He vowed to overcome the nagging hardships of the global economic crisis, the roots of which, he pointedly noted, again, were not in Russia. He barely mentioned Medvedev's nomination to head the party list or his own return to the presidency, which in one sudden moment had become inexorable. "We have already entered a lengthy election cycle. The elections to the State Duma will take place on December 4th, to be followed by the formation of its committees and government bodies. The presidential election is scheduled for next spring. I'd like to thank you for your positive response to the proposal for me to stand for president. This is a great honor for me." He spoke as if he had not decided everything himself. The agreement was reached several years ago, Putin had explained. Medvedev suggested as much as well, though in fact it had not happened that way. Medvedev had nurtured the hope to return for a second term at least until the beginning of September, when his public demeanor started to suggest that it might not happen. He had only learned the details of Putin's final decision the night before, during a late-night meeting at Nova Agareva. When the printers printed the ballots for the delegates to use to elevate Medvedev to the head of the party, the space for his name had been left blank, filled in only after the announcement. According to one account, Putin would not even let Medvedev tell his wife until the decision had been made public. If Putin had known all along that he intended to reclaim the presidency, no one else in the government or in his inner circle had been allowed to know, let alone influence the outcome of his deliberations. He made the most momentous decision of his political career with his own counsel alone. One of Medvedev's loyalists, Arkady Dvorkovich, reacted with anguished sarcasm, even as the events at the Congress unfolded. In an interview the year before, Dvorkovich had acknowledged that Medvedev's plans, and really his entire presidency, had faced opposition from those who thrive on the old system, on budget inefficiency and a resource-based economy. He never named names, but he clearly referred to those arrayed around Putin. "Now," he tweeted from the floor of the party's Congress, "it's time to switch to the sports channel." Putin never bothered to explain his reasons for returning to the presidency, to the Kremlin. He could have remained the paramount leader, even with Medvedev serving another term as president. Perhaps there was no reason but the obvious one, though according to his most ardent supporters, he felt that his successor had not been a strong enough leader. In the days and months after the announcement, the same supporters set about demeaning Medvedev for the weaknesses he showed during the war in Georgia and failing to stop NATO's war in Libya. Even the anecdote about keeping Medvedev from telling his wife was laced with the insinuation that he was hardly man enough to trust his wife not to insist that he run again. These explanations sought to justify Putin's move, but they did not explain his motive. He never felt he had to. The position was his if he wanted it, which was, in his mind apparently, explanation enough. Suddenly, the significance of the constitutional change to lengthen the presidential term dawned on those who rued a new Putin presidency. Instead of 4 more years, Putin would serve 6, until 2018. If he ran for another term after that, a 4th, he could be Russia's leader until 2024, surpassing Brezhnev in political longevity. Only Stalin, in power for 31 years, had remained in office longer. Putin's critics and even some supporters began to count the years of their own lives, envisioning their ages when, under the managed democracy the Kremlin had imposed, another leader might conceivably emerge in Russia. Photographs enhanced to show the aging process became popular memes on the internet. The opposition newspaper Novaya Gazeta published pencil caricatures of Putin at the presumed end of his political career, his face creased with age, his hairline even further receded, his suit festooned with a field marshal's clusters of medals and ribbons. His senior aides were all there too, those who had been with him from the beginning, looking like the hunched veterans of the great patriotic war, still revered and honored for deeds of a distant past. Medvedev, having been the hope of the liberals and reformers, faced even more ridicule than Putin. The decision to switch positions became known by the Russian word for castling in chess, rokirovka, in which the king swaps position with the rook, most often to solidify the defense of the king. No one doubted now who had always held the power, even those who had hoped that Medvedev would one day establish himself as an independent leader. Theirs was the bitter anger of disappointment. Whether or not the decision was made in 2008 or in 2011, Medvedev proved to be nothing more than a pawn in Putin's gambit to sidestep the letter of the law that limited a leader's term. Russians derisively reckoned his greatest accomplishments to be the reduction of Russia's 11 time zones to 9 and the permanent shift to daylight saving time. A day after the announcement, a putative ally, the finance minister Alexei Kudrin, publicly broke with Medvedev, saying he would refuse to remain in a cabinet with Medvedev as prime minister. Medvedev tried to explain his decision by saying that he and Putin had agreed to let opinion polls decide who would run, as if those in Russia were genuine reflections of voter sentiment. But he made matters worse by using the hated United States as a standard of comparison. It was inconceivable, he said, to imagine that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, being from the same party, would ever compete against each other. They're both from the Democratic Party, so they made a decision based on who was capable of bringing the best result, he said, less than a week after the Congress. We made the same kind of decision. The fact that this ignored the heated Democratic primaries of 2008 only stoked the derision. Putin, having in his mind observed and respected the letter of Russia's constitution, miscalculated the reaction to his return. He had grown increasingly isolated and detached from the popular sentiment he believed he understood intuitively. The successes he so often touted, stability and, despite the economic crisis, spreading affluence, were no longer sufficient to assuage a new generation that took them for granted. The chaos of the 1990s was a distant memory, and many of those who had benefited most from the Putin boom now expected a more modern, more open political culture as well. The Kremlin maintained its ironclad grip on the television narrative, but the videocracy at the center of its mystique had grown stale, subject to the satire that has been a feature of Russian literature since Gogol. Opposition to the rokirovka churned in the arena, still largely beyond the Kremlin's manipulations. Frustration and anger over Putin's return filled social media and online networks, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, and its Russian clone, VKontakte, and the animosity turned into an uprising, though for now a virtual one. The architects of the rebellion were disproportionately from the educated class, those with money and technical savvy, those who swam easily in the media that obliterated traditional borders of communication. They were called Internet hamsters, and they produced a primal stream of denunciations and jeremiads, spoofs, and mockery that freely ridiculed Putin, his antics, his evident cosmetic surgery, his humiliated sidekick, in ways that the official media had long ago stopped daring to do. The discontent soon spread. When Putin appeared in the ring of an Ultimate Fight match at Olympic Stadium in Moscow in November, he was greeted by booing and whistling, though the Kremlin's supporters tried unconvincingly to suggest the audience's ire was directed at the loser of the bout, an American, or the long lines for the bathrooms. A heavily edited clip appeared on the evening news, with the booing muted, but the raw video spread online, picked up by Alexei Navalny, who gleefully pronounced Putin's harsh reception from the fans as the end of an era. Putin had faced angry constituents before, but in this case, the booing came from a crowd that would presumably include his most ardent supporters. Putin's opponents took heart in the unseemly display, which challenged the myth that opposition to Putin existed only in the rarefied elite, the intelligentsia, as they were once called, or the new generation who preferred a new adaptation from the West, hipster. With the news of his return to the Kremlin, Putin's popularity actually slipped to the lowest levels since 2000. The party his strategists had constructed slipped even further, dismissed by its growing legion of critics as a badly reconstituted Communist Party of the Soviet Union, only more corrupt. By the time the parliamentary elections were held in December, it became clear that the foundation of Putin's power had fractured. The models that had worked since 2000 were no longer enough. The Kremlin's creation of a new pro-business opposition party called Right Cause, intended to inject a semblance of intrigue into the country's politics, became a farce when its recruited leader, the billionaire Mikhail Prokhorov, found his supporters barred from attending the party congress organized to nominate him. No one had given the party any chance of winning, but Medvedev had persuaded Prokhorov to take up politics, only to have the machinations of the Kremlin's political mastermind, Vladislav Surkov, shoulder him aside. Prokhorov, a businessman who bought the New Jersey, later Brooklyn Nets of the National Basketball Association in 2010, had naively assumed that he might exercise political independence. He claimed that Putin's power was not monolithic and that he had supporters inside its ranks, but his ouster made it clear they were losing out. In Russia, he said, all fights are on the inside. The parliamentary elections thus unfolded like those before, with the same stunted, state-sanctioned parties that had become grizzled fixtures of the political status quo. They became known as the system opposition, nominally a check on power, but one wholly subservient to it. Zyuganov's communists, Zhirinovsky's liberal democrats, and the rebranded version of the nationalists, now called Just Russia and led by Sergei Mironov, the Putin acolyte who had challenged him in the 2004. Other smaller parties that might have posed a challenge, like Yabloko or Boris Nemtsov's, were smothered by the electoral or legal bureaucracy, harassed or barred from registering at all. Even if they could have made it to the ballot, Putin's genuine opponents were so diverse and diffuse, so adrift after more than a decade on the political margins, that they failed to unite behind any one party or leader. Some had resigned themselves to boycott, but activists like Navalny urged them to vote anyway, for anyone but the party of swindlers and thieves. The goal now was not to win. It was to expose elections in Russia for the Potemkin artifice they had become. Putin remained defiant, to the point that he seemed oblivious to the dangerous discontent that seethed beneath Russia's chimera of progress and prosperity. It's too early to organize my funeral, he told the Valdai gathering barely a week before the vote, brushing aside even the fawning or dutiful questions of those who attended. The fate of United Russia was another matter. its popularity had plummeted, and polls suggested that it would lose its constitutional majority. It might not even win a majority at all. All the bureaucrats and boyars who depended on Putin's system were increasingly haunted by the specter of the Orange Revolution and now the Arab Spring, which had toppled strongman after strongman like dominoes. Suddenly, the armies of subversion seemed to be everywhere. Mubarak was in jail, Gaddafi was dead, and Assad was besieged by an armed rebellion that had fractured Syria along bloody fault lines. Putin would not be the next. The Kremlin's anxiety manifested itself in heavy-handed efforts to ensure a high enough turnout and vote for United Russia. Even before Election Day, a voting rights organization called Golos, the word for vote as well as voice, recorded thousands of violations of the country's election laws. Funded by foreign organizations supporting democracy, Golos annotated the violations on an online map that soon went viral, picked up by even relatively loyal newspapers and websites. Putin told steelworkers in Petersburg that election observers were the agents of foreign powers trying to destabilize the country. He even compared Golos to Judas. The group was promptly fined for violating the election law it was determined to enforce by publishing its map. Its director was detained for hours at a Moscow airport the night before the election and released only after surrendering her laptop. The organization's website came under a computer attack that shut it down just as voting began. The same thing happened to other sites, including the popular and influential radio station Echo Moskvy, which remained offline, almost certainly, not coincidentally, until the polls closed. The Kremlin, which had once acted as if the internet were a harmless diversion of the spoiled elite, now moved decisively to curtail its influence. Although all the previous elections of Putin's Russia had been marred by abuses and manipulation, the fraud that unfolded on December 4th was far more widespread and cynical. Despite the efforts of the authorities, the internet now allowed evidence of violations to spread through the public consciousness. Official election observers could not be everywhere, but amateur videos taken with cell phones appeared online, showing apparatchiks flagrantly stuffing ballot boxes, shepherding busloads of voters from polling station to polling station, even using invisible ink on ballots. In one video taken by a volunteer activist and promptly uploaded to YouTube, the elderly director of polling place number 2501 in Moscow sat at a desk dutifully marking a stack of ballots. The international observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe concluded that one in three polling stations experienced some sort of suspect activity, but that only counted the small percentage where observers were present. The flagrant disregard for electoral decency provoked outrage when unofficial results showed that United Russia had won just under 50% of the vote. Enough, given the parties that did not make it to the threshold for winning seats, to allow it to retain a majority in the new Duma. It was clear that even that diminished result was a fraud, one that required the complicity of thousands upon thousands of people to carry out, from election officials like Vladimir Churov, a KGB colleague of Putin's from Petersburg, to state workers, forced by fear or favor to staff the polling stations, to the journalists of state media who struggled to report it all with straight faces. Even Putin, appearing to declare victory with Medvedev at United Russia's campaign headquarters, appeared less than exultant. The scale of the fraud at last was enough to stir thousands from the political apathy that had accompanied the rise of Putinism and the stultifying bureaucratic stagnation that it had produced. On the night after the election, as the final and official results were announced, the small opposition party Solidarity held a rally at Chisteprudy near the center of Moscow. The party's periodic protests typically drew a few hundred people, who were always outnumbered by the police officers deployed to keep a close watch. This time, despite a cold rain, thousands showed up, drawn by appeals on the internet. Speaker after speaker clutched a microphone and made demands and ultimatums. The people there were diverse, their ideas inchoate. Some of the old opposition leaders, the veterans of Glasnost and the liberals of the Yeltsin years, were there, but others had never attended a protest before. The speaker who got the most attention was Alexei Navalny, whose campaign against corruption arguably contributed most to this outburst of activism. He had an enormous following online, but now here he stood in the flesh, shouting into a microphone to a crowd that waved flags and handmade banners with slogans like "Putin, thief," and the scarcely imaginable "Russia without Putin." "They can call us microbloggers or internet hamsters," he roared. "I am an internet hamster, and I'll be at the throats of those beasts." Navalny and dozens of other protesters and protest organizers were arrested as they left the park to march toward the Election Commission's headquarters. He was jailed for 15 days, charged with resisting arrest, and yet the protests continued. They even began to swell. The next Saturday, tens of thousands showed up at Bolotnaya Square, across the river from the Kremlin. They proved undaunted by the arrests, undaunted by counter-protests that had been organized by the virulent youth group Nashi, which had been created after Ukraine's Orange Revolution for just this purpose. Undaunted by veiled threats from the authorities, including a warning that young men of draft age would be picked up and inducted into the army. 2 weeks later, on December 24th, nearly 100,000 massed, this time on the avenue named after Andrei Sakharov, the nuclear physicist and Soviet dissident whose legacy of championing a democratic society had by then diminished significantly. Navalny was there this time. After his 15 days in prison, he had emerged to a throng of supporters chanting his name on a dark, snowy evening. He said he had gone into prison in one country and come out into a new one. He turned his attention beyond the fraud in the parliamentary elections to the fraud in the presidential election scheduled for March 4th. "What will happen on the 4th of March," he told them, "if it will happen, will be an illegal succession to the throne." The protests were the largest of the Putin era, the largest, in fact, since those in 1991 that had resisted the August Putsch. They spread to other cities, attracting a broad spectrum of society: government workers, laborers, pensioners, students, the workers who filled the offices of new businesses that capitalism had brought. That the protests were peaceful made them even more terrifying to the Kremlin. Putin had said little at first, ignoring the allegations of fraud, but he greeted the prospect of a popular uprising with icy, sarcastic derision. 3 days after the vote, speaking to organizers of his coming presidential campaign, he blamed the ongoing protests on Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, who had criticized the conduct of the election. "She set the tone for some actors in our country and gave them a signal," he said. "They heard the signal and, with the support of the State Department, began active work." Even his use of the phrase "active work," a term he had learned in the KGB, underscored his belief that the protests were neither indigenous nor spontaneous, but rather an intelligence operation. In his annual televised call-in show in December, he went further. He mocked the white ribbons that protesters had adopted as a symbol of their cause, saying they reminded him of condoms pinned to their coats. He compared the protesters to the Bundarlog, the wild monkeys of Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book, which had appeared as a Soviet television series when Putin was a teenager. You could not really reason with them, the monkeys, but they were afraid of the snake, Kar, who ultimately subdued them with his hypnotic power. "I've loved Kipling since I was a child," Putin said, with an impish smile. Despite his nonchalance, the vast bureaucracy beneath Putin seemed deeply shaken, and Putin's scorn seemed to embolden those protesting and detract even more. Protesters now showed up at rallies with condoms blown up like balloons, with stuffed animals and posters depicting monkeys and apes, and Putin, as Kar, strangling the nation. The government's outward unity began to show signs of the divisions inside. Medvedev first claimed that the viral videos of ballot stuffing were faked, but later he promised that the authorities would investigate any allegations. The Speaker of the Duma, Boris Gritslov, promised to allow members of opposition parties to serve as committee chairmen, hoping to temper the anger at United Russia's dominance. Then, under pressure, he resigned. The Kremlin demoted its gray cardinal, Vladislav Surkov, the strategist who was credited and reviled for erecting the managed democracy that was the focus of the protesters' ire. Only days before, Surkov had said the protesters represented the best part of our society, or more accurately, the most productive part. Journalists at NTV, owned by Gazprom, refused to go on the air if the channel refused to cover the December 10th protest. And, for the first time, the Kremlin's media masters relented, allowing the public display of dissent to appear on television channels broadcasting across the country, though without mentioning the anger directed toward Putin. Members of the Putin elite, the academics, political strategists, bureaucrats, even the clerics of the Orthodox Church, who had always remained loyal, began to raise questions about the fraud, including Alexei Kudrin, who spoke at the rally on December 24th and called on his former bosses to make the system more accountable. Few, not even the protesters braving the cold, believed the protest would succeed in bringing about a new election or even a meaningful investigation of the fraud, and fewer still doubted that Putin would be re-elected in March. But for the first time, uncertainty haunted Putin's rule. The Russian stock market slumped after the election, and as in every crisis, capital flight accelerated. A fear crept into the elite, above all those most heavily invested in Putin's leadership. Vladimir Litvinenko, the rector of the Mining Institute in Petersburg, where Putin had written his thesis, expressed the sentiments of many of them. He had remained close to his former student, and he had become a wealthy man, compensated, he claimed, for the consultation work he had done for the government with shares in Foss Agro, a company whose core asset had been seized from Mikhail Khodorkovsky's financial empire after his conviction. Only months before, the company had gone public on the London Stock Exchange. His fear now echoed Putin's of the past. The fear of the mob, the unruly hordes in the street, demanding respect and justice, the rabble toppling those in power and coating the street in blood. "I horribly fear the street," he said, as the protests swelled. "This is an uprising. This is revolution, not evolution, with all the negative consequences of disorder on the street. This is the path to nowhere, I am certain. This is a catastrophe. We will do everything to prevent this in my country."